welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, and CFRC. So a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It's a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on. And today, I would like to introduce you to Anna Smythe, who's doing an MA in Classics and Archaeology under the supervision of Dr. Jean-Mathieu Carbon and Dr. Barbara Reeves. Welcome to Grad Chat, Anna.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for coming, especially on a chilly morning like this.
Not cold to my standards.
Okay.
But I appreciate it nonetheless.
And I'm really excited to hear about your research today. But before we dive into this, can you tell us a little bit about what attracted you to Queen's in the first place? Like, what brought you here?
For sure. So when I was doing my undergrad at the University of Alberta in Classical Studies, I knew I wanted to go on to a master's, but I wasn't quite sure in what. So when I hit my fourth year, I was like, I need to be able to afford this.
Yeah.
And so I started to apply for the SHRC, and I had to give them a research proposal. And that was terrifying because I had never written one of those before, and I had no clue what I was going to be doing in a year. I was also working on my honors thesis at the time, and so it was a lot. But I knew that I wanted to do a shift. At that point, I was working on researching the myth of Theseus, which is a red flag, but I don't like him. So I wanted to try and shift my focus towards subordinate studies and subordinate voices, meaning just folks we don't normally hear from in the classical record who are marginalized, of lower socioeconomic status. And I wasn't quite sure how to do that, because basically nothing, almost, survives as a primary source from subordinate groups or subordinate people. So I started looking into graffiti initially, which is kind of a subsection of epigraphy or the study of inscriptions, to try and figure out if I could find anything, because I thought that's something that's a bit more accessible. In theory, anyone could write graffiti, because all you need is a writing implement and a surface to write on. I looked into that, and there was very, very little in Greek, and I wanted to do Greek because I liked it better than Latin, and I was better at it. I was also more well-versed in ancient Greece than I was at ancient Rome at that point. And there was very little that I could find. But I ended up finding a subsection of graffiti, which we'll talk about later as part of my MA research. And from there, I started to go, okay, I can do this in Greek epigraphy, because there's the potential for subordinate voices to exist in epigraphy, even if it's very rare, when that basically doesn't exist in our literary written record. And it's very, very difficult to argue in the archaeological record in classics. So I went that route, started looking for Greek epigraphers in Canada and abroad, and wow, there's not many of them. And so I found a couple, and eventually I found one of my supervisors, Dr. Jean-Mathieu Carbon, and he researched Greek epigraphy. He was at Queen's, and the department also had someone that researched graffiti, though, on the Roman side of things, which is Dr. Barbara Reeves.
Oh, perfect.
And I was like, oh, that's a great combination. And so I applied here. I got my offer letter, and they offered me as well enough funding to be able to afford to do a master's, which was very helpful for me. And so their combined expertises plus my funding eventually led me to come here. And now I'm in my second year and loving it.
Oh, very nice. Well, it sounds like it was a combination of factors, but the convergence of which makes it possible to do this cool research that we get to talk about today.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you mentioned a little bit about epigraphy already, but your research topic looks at two case studies in ancient Greek everyday writing, potentially written by subordinate people, which you kind of mentioned. But can you tell us a little bit about more about your topic and give us a bit of an overview of your topic?
For sure. So what I mean by everyday writing is basically I'm trying to look at mediums that are a bit more accessible. So everyday writing examples can be things like letters or graffiti or curse tablets, which don't sound immediately accessible, but they're a lot more common than you would think in ancient Greece and Rome. It's anything like that anyone could have written, right? Because if they had the literacy to do so, they would have the accessibility to the materials and, in theory, the knowledge of how to format that specific piece of writing, because they were decently widespread. So my two case studies are the collection of Attic Herder's graffiti that was found by Dr. Merle Langdon. They're, if you go to visit them today, they're on the outskirts of Athens in a very empty kind of outside of suburbia area on a bunch of hills that are terrible to navigate because of the prickly oak. And they date to approximately the Archaic period, which is just before the Classical period. So we're looking at the 7th and 6th centuries BCE, approximately. And I'm also looking at the Dodona oracular tablets. These are inscriptions written on little lead tablets in Greek. They date from approximately the 6th to the 2nd centuries BCE, so a very wide range. And there's thousands of them.
Wow.
I know, it's crazy.
That's a lot for a classic scholar.
Yeah, I'm not looking at all of them. I have, sorry, I'm getting loud. I have a selection of them. I'm looking at about 16 of them in total. But within those tablets, there are inscriptions potentially written by subordinate people, which we don't find very often. And the Attic Herder's graffiti are so named because they're rock-cut graffiti potentially written by herders. And identifying who's written both of these is difficult and can never be certain.
Of course, yes.
But there are indications in both that suggest they were written by subordinate people, herders specifically for the graffiti. And specifically within the tablets I'm looking at to compare as much as I can to the Attic Herder's graffiti, one's potentially written by herders. And I'm also looking at ones potentially written by enslaved people, because there is so little that we have that survived written by enslaved people in ancient Greece. And this was a phenomenal opportunity to be able to examine a group of them from the same context. And of course, that spans a couple decades. And the ones I'm looking at go from approximately the 6th to the 4th centuries BCE. But you don't normally find them grouped together. And so that was my thorough path into being able to try and study potentially direct voices from the past of subordinate people.
Wow, that sounds really exciting, because like you said, there's so few things, and even in more modern circumstances, there's so few things from subordinate people. So that's very exciting that you've identified two different areas that you can research on, two different groups of people that span this period, and to give you some comparison and to pull out some big themes. So how are you analyzing these collections?
So I'm doing it in kind of a piecemeal way, if that makes sense. Any kind of analysis of anything that's potentially written by subordinate people warrants a lot of caution, because our record, the classical record, is predominantly written by wealthy male slaveholders. So especially in the case of enslaved people, we have to be very, very, very careful that we don't, if there are primary voices in front of us, muddle that with modern interpretation. And of course, that applies as well to herders and to other folks of lower socioeconomic status. But keeping that in mind, I'm examining the text that survives, which can be difficult because these especially in the case of the lead tablets, the Dodona tablets, a lot of them have been folded, and so they've been unfolded to examine them, resulting in cracks, and sometimes the writing has smudged or been pressed down so it's very faint, and sometimes there's chunks of a tablet missing, and we don't know how much is missing because it breaks off at what we have now as an edge.
Of course.
And the same happens with the graffiti, in that they've been exposed to the elements for centuries. So they can be quite hard to read because they're so faint now and hard to find. And so I'm looking at what survives of the text to try and figure out, okay, what's the purpose of this text? Why did the author write this? Was it actually written by an enslaved person or a herder? How can we tell that? How can we argue this? How certain is that argument? And then I'll be looking at things like, are there any connections in what they're talking about? So are they talking about wanting freedom? Are they talking about cows. There's an assortment of topics that we find in the tablets. And I'm also examining the tablets and the graffiti through a paleographic lens, which is the study of ancient writing. This is where my research is somewhat innovative, because to my knowledge at least, no one has tried to examine sources from subordinate people via their paleography. So I'd be looking at things like handwriting, errors in the text, like spelling errors, grammatical errors, and in general, how the text is aligned on the tablet. And I'm doing so to see if I can identify any sociolinguistic indicators of status. Mm-hmm. My current theory is that I will not be able to. And so far, I have not been able to, which is phenomenal because then I get to say, we all can assume that this group of people is diverse. Mm-hmm. And here is, yeah, I can accurately say that yes, at least in the ones that I'm looking at, they are diverse in their literacy, in how they pen their tablets, in how they inscribe graffiti, so on and so forth.
Oh, that's really interesting. So it sounds like you're doing a lot in this project, many different things, many approaches, lots of different sources in the selections you've made. And it sounds like you're making quite an intervention as well and looking at some different things. So why is epigraphy or this everyday writing so important to the study of subordinate people in antiquity and especially pre-Hellenistic Greece? And I think you've touched on this a little bit, but what does it do for the field and for us and in general?
For sure. I have touched on it a little bit, but I always love to expand upon
it.
More people should study epigraphy. Maybe I'm biased on that, but epigraphy is one of the fields in classics that's continually revealing new information about the ancient world. It's hard to do that in our literary sources. A lot of our literary works survive in papyrus, which predominantly comes from Egypt, and normally does not date before the Hellenistic period. I don't know of a single instance of papyrus from before the Hellenistic period. And so when you're trying to learn about ancient Greece or Rome before, you know, 323 BCE, it's difficult if you're looking only through written word, not through epigraphy. Epigraphy is the exception to that because it survives, not amazingly, but it does survive sometimes on less perishable material like lead or rock. Also, you can find it on pottery as well, though the lines blur between disciplines at that point. It might actually be papyrology at that point, because if it's painted on a potsherd, is that not like painting on papyrus? I think the distinctions don't matter personally in that case, but that's where it gets a bit blurry. So looking at epigraphy can reveal sources of information and information in general that we don't have through the literary record or even through the archaeological record. Literary record has the benefit of being more informative more easily because we can look at the words and be like, okay, it says this. There's, of course, nuance in what are the biases of the author. Does this word mean which of 17 definitions that it could be in this context? Are there dialect stuff that we have to look out for? But it's hard to do that kind of interpretation in archaeology, for example, because you don't have written explanations of what's going on. So if you find a group of loom weights in a room in what you think is a house, for example, can you say, okay, I think this room was specifically used to weave? It's possible, but hard to argue. It could be that the person who owned this house just felt like throwing their loom weights out in this room.
Yeah, just like we do, right? You just throw your gym bag in the corner for storage. Maybe you throw loom weights in the corner for storage, too, until you go back to weaving.
Exactly. So it's hard to interpret anything. Well, you have to do it by comparing material, of course. And that's when you bring in the literary record when you're analyzing stuff archaeologically to support your analysis and try and fill the holes in the information in front of you. And epigraphy is a nice middle ground between the two, where you have a material source that has come from likely an archaeological context, but it also has writing on it. And so, for example, you can use inscriptions to identify the owners of a house. At one point, point in time. It might say, like, you know, Julia and Philip, and then give a date under perhaps a statue that was in the house or maybe above a threshold somewhere. And you can then say, okay, very likely Julia and Philip owned or at least lived in this house from this point to this point. Great. Beautiful. So epigraphy can help contextualize finds from archaeology and from our literary sources. And both archaeology and our literary sources are almost bereft of direct voices from subordinate people. Mm-hmm. You can use the literary record to gain some information about maybe what it would have been like to live as a subordinate person in ancient Greece. But it's very, very difficult because more often than not, our authors are the elite people that are oppressing these subordinate people.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to be very careful. So especially when doing subordinate studies in classics, epigraphy is very important as one of the few potential windows in directly into the lived experience of subordinate people.
And where does subordinate studies in the field of classics and archaeology currently fit? Like, what's the significance of it in the field?
So classics and archaeology is a field with a very colonialist history.
Mm.
It started with Europeans believing that Rome and Greece were the ideal societies and that they, as imperial powers, should emulate Rome and Greece in their heydays, I'm using air quotes here, of their imperial powers. Mm. So especially they'd look at Athens' empire or Rome's empire to justify and model themselves after those imperialist tendencies and conquerings.
Mm-hmm.
So at the beginning, the field focused almost entirely on the literary aspect of Greece and of Rome, and it was not great, in my opinion, at least. So now in the modern day, because classics, Greece and Rome, are so influential in popular culture still.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we had that Gladiator movie, the sequel, come out recently.
Mm-hmm.
There's an Odyssey movie coming up very, very soon. It still pervades modern thought. And some of the biases from Greece and from Rome, and also from how our field started, still pervade. So the especially thought of, like, West versus East in Greece's wars against Persia to justify Western ideas of democracy versus Islam, especially.
Mm.
Islamophobia is rampant in our field's past. And so studying subordinate studies now is a way to advance the field, to learn more about antiquity, to help us better understand how we got to where we are as people who live in North America and more broadly the Western, with air quotes, world in general, by modeling ourselves off of these two countries. And it can help challenge our modern biases as well. And you can't do that without challenging Roman and Greek biases, ancient ones, from the authors that have survived. And so subordinate studies is a way to do that and to learn more about especially the darker sides of Greece and of Rome, and to get a better, more well-rounded understanding of those countries, civilizations, and to get a better understanding of our own as well.
Mm.
So that's why I think it's important.
No, it's incredibly important, right? You're getting this, like you so eloquently said, this fuller picture of the past, but also seeing those echoes in the present and understanding, you know, where the field has gone and how it follows kind of the flows and influences of the current day and how you see those reflected back in the past and forward. So that's, I think, very important.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that you've got these two case studies, the Attic Herder's graffiti and the Dodona oracular tablets. Why did you choose these two case studies in particular?
Mm-hmm. So because I'm looking at my material through a paleographic lens, it involves a lot of comparison between the tablets and between the graffiti. So I can't accurately compare Herder's graffiti to Herder's tablets, at least with any certainty, because they are two different media in two different parts of Greece and it potentially centuries apart, depending on when my tablets are dating to. So I chose them because they had a large enough corpus size that I could do that internal comparison. So I'd be comparing the tablets potentially written by enslaved people with tablets potentially written by enslaved people.
Mm-hmm.
to try and see if there was anything within that context mm-hmm. that those tablets share that can indicate differences or similarities. So I needed to have a corpus size large enough to be able to do those comparisons mm-hmm. without having very unreliable results. Mm-hmm. And these two source types, the Herder's Graffiti and the Dodona Oracular tablets, are like pretty well the only ones I could find mm-hmm. in ancient Greek from ancient Greece that were large enough to fit my standards. Even then, they're not very large. And there's, of course, difficulties of identifying authors in both of them, mm. especially for the tablets. I'm sure there are more tablets written by enslaved people that we simply cannot identify because there's no surviving indicators that they were enslaved. Mm. Maybe they're not talking about wanting to be free. Maybe they're asking a question about a trial that's coming up or about their home life. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't be able to know that they're enslaved. Mm. So the only tablets I can look at are the ones that either identify something about enslavement or, and this is where it gets a little bit more uncertain, contain the name of the person who is likely writing the tablet, and that name is attested elsewhere as most often or always in what we have that's survived belonging to an enslaved person.
Okay, yeah.
And it's the same with the Herders. Pretty well, all of my tablets that are potentially written by Herders talk about animals. Cows, sheep, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. And some of them talk about pasturage and things like that. But there are very likely more tablets that were written by Herders that I just simply cannot identify. And for the Herder's Graffiti, they are identified as such because of the longer extant graffiti that we have. Sometimes the authors will identify themselves as Herders. Oh, that's beautiful. It's probably unlikely that they're lying. That's not the simplest answer. So if we go Occam's razor, it's very likely that they were indeed Herders. And also, there's nothing around that area. I've been there. There's nothing. So the water's nearby, and we're on a hill in the countryside, but there's no temples around. Mm. There's no architecture that's survived. It's just hills. So the prevailing theory is that, well, who would have reason to go to an area of just hills? And that's, well, potentially Herders.
Yes. And then if they call themselves a Herder, even better, right?
Exactly.
Confirmed. And so you mentioned you visit some of these places. So are your case study selections, are they, well, like the graffitis in on site, mm-hmm. but are your other, your Dodona oracular tablets, do you have to visit those in person as well? And what does that process look like?
Great question. So I needed to autopsy or to examine both of these sources in person because of my stipulation on paleography. Mm-hmm. I need to find the grittiness of the writing or I will have no substance to my arguments. This is furthered in that both of them were only published in sketch form.
Okay.
So the archaeologists and the professors who first recorded and analyzed and published these pieces of writing didn't do so with photographs, which makes it harder to analyze the paleography, and especially in the case of the Dodona tablets, where there are over 4,000 inscriptions that these archaeologists had to go through, and quite frankly, some of them are really hard to read, as I learned when I was there. I wanted to go through with my own eyes to just see what the differences between the sketches published were versus when I was actually looking at the text. I'm also new to epigraphy, so I wanted the experience as well so that I could better understand the process of making sketches and be able to more critically analyze how sketches are made and how they're published so that I can go in with my own knowledge to make my assessments that way as well. So the Herder's Graffiti are indeed in situ. They're on site because they're on the ground.
Of course, yes.
And I was able to go there with the help of Dr. Stella Scalza, who was through so kind in offering to take me in her car to this area. And we spent probably a good 4 to 6 hours romping around the Attic countryside trying to find these graffiti. I had communicated with Merle Langdon, who very kindly gave me an approximate location for the two pieces of graffiti that I was going to look at. I didn't, unfortunately, have time or the resources to find more than that, as evidenced by how it took me 6 hours to find the second one. So I had an aerial photo, and I had a map, and then I had Google Maps open on my phone. And so we were walking around the hill being like, I think we're almost there. And we managed to find them. The sun had indeed set by the time we found the second one. But it's okay. We found them in the end. And so with her very, very gracious help and patience, we managed to find what we were looking for. And then for the tablets, they are currently housed in the Archaeological Museum of Yenina. And with the very gracious permission of the Greek Ministry of Culture and Sport and the effort of antiquities at Yenina, I was able to go to Yenina, which is in northern Greece, and examine these tablets firsthand. They're currently stored in the museum, the Archaeological Museum of Yenina. And so I was sat in their basement doing my best to examine tablets for the first time. This was before I did the graffiti. And so it was a lot of me looking at the lead tablets under a microscope going, oh God, why did three people write over each other on this tablet? And why didn't they think of me, the student 2,000 years in the future who's going to be trying to read this? I'm joking.
Of course, yeah.
It was tempting to think that way sometimes, but I, of course, stay impartial as an academic and managed to eventually read all of them as best that I could. So that was a very long-winded answer to your question.
It's interesting, right, to see how people approach different sources, and these are very unique source types, again, of likely subordinate people, and in two different places, and even though they're both in situ, held in very different contexts as well. You've got an outdoor site that you have to navigate, and then you have a museum site which you also have to negotiate, right, to get access. So they're very different ways to access these two case studies that you're working on. So thank you for telling us about that. How do you keep notes on all of these things? Are you allowed to photograph anything? You mentioned sketches. Do you have time to make sketches of everything? What does that look like?
I've made sketches of all of the pieces that I've looked at. I'm currently in the process of editing the ones for the tablets in particular, because my idea with doing the sketches is to better define what I was seeing in the photographs, because quite frankly, even with my photographs, which I think turned out pretty well for the most part, it is still hard to read what's on those tablets. And the way they were published in the original corpus, the DVC is normally how it's abbreviated in 2013, is that the archaeologists that published these sketches did so where there was one sketch per inscription on the tablet. So for tablets that were palimpsests, so overwritten quite often with maybe like 4 to 7 different inscriptions on them, they published 4 to 7 different sketches where they isolated that one inscription and then did the same for all the rest, which is phenomenal when you're trying to read the tablets, because
gives you a little bit of a roadmap to start from.
But as a result, those sketches were meant to elucidate the Greek on the tablet, and so they sometimes didn't contain the grittiness that I was looking for my particular studies. So I was like, okay, in that case, I'll sketch the tablet as it is. I'm not doing multiple sketches, those already exist. I'll put them all over top of each other, great. And I did that, and I did it all in the same color, and then I went, I can't read this. So now I'm going back through, and I'm making the different inscriptions different colors so that you can distinguish them between each other while also still being able to tell what's going on. Because keeping them the same color lost the information of what inscription was more clearly defined, what was fainter because it was older and it had been worn down a bit more, what was penned in a different way so this one looks sharper, maybe it was written with a point, whereas the other one looks a bit more blunt. That information was lost when I made that sketch, as I did initially. And for the graffiti, my sketches so far look very, very similar to what Dr. Merle Langdon has published. So the graffiti then has both survived a bit better than the Dodona tablets, which sometimes a piece has fallen off now. So you're missing a couple letters here and there. But at the same time, the graffiti is still hard to read. and very little of it has actually been published. Mm. So I did find some like personal names strewn around in the same context, in the same area as the graffiti that I was graffito that I was initially setting out to examine. So my sketches include whatever's around it in the proximity, just to say in context, this is what's around.
Yeah.
Because when I'm examining graffiti, the benefit of it being in situ is I get to say, here's the context and here's why I think this graffiti is clustered in this way. Or here's why I think it's in this area, which is probably not going to have anything good on it, if I'm being honest, because it's all just rock and brush. And who knows how the landscape has changed since that these graffiti were written. But yeah, so yes, I've made sketches. I also took photographs, and I have permission to publish the photographs of the tablets.
Exciting,
so that's
yeah.
beautiful. And I again thank everyone in Greece for giving me a chance to do this. So there should be some photos in my thesis once it is done.
Oh, that's very exciting. Yes, yeah. No, that's great that you've got permission, because sometimes you can look at things for scholarship, but they have to stay, you know, with the rights stay with whatever institution is hosting those those sources. So that is very kind of them. That's great to see. So it sounds like your project is, it takes a lot to do this type of work, but I also know that you are involved in a lot of other things outside of research. I don't know when you have time for these things, but you do have a list of them.
I don't. And yet I do them anyway.
But I hear that you've been a dungeon master for Dungeons and Dragons for quite some time. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
For sure. So I started DMing or being a dungeon master in 2019, I think. So about 7 years ago now.
Wow, yeah.
Got together with a group of high school friends and I went, we want to try playing D&D. None of us had played before. I had read that it was a mistake to start out playing D&D as a dungeon master. Learned quickly that that was correct, but stuck with it anyways. And we had a campaign that lasted 5 years.
Wow.
And literally the day before I flew out to Ontario to move to Kingston, we wrapped up our campaign, finished the big final battle that I had planned for like years. And I mean, I miss it, but I'm playing again now, which I'm very happy about, with some people in my graduate cohort.
Oh, lovely.
So we've recently started Curse of Strahd, so vampires and werewolves and ghosts, things like that, and I'm excited to scare them.
We won't ask for details, so you can keep your tricks up your sleeve for them all. And that you also volunteer as a tutor on the Classics and Archaeology Graduate Council. What is that like?
So we this year started the initiative of offering free tutoring once a week to any students who are taking Latin or Ancient Greek at the 100 level or above who want extra help in the languages. Mm. So every Monday we meet for an hour and a half to 2 hours with anyone who wants the extra help. The reason we started this through our graduate council is because of the funding cuts that have happened recently. Mm. We've had to reduce the amount of classes that first-year Latin and Greek students get per week. So normally when you learn a 100 level Latin or Greek course, and this is the same at the University of Alberta and at most universities in Canada, you do 4 classes a week of learning.
Yeah. Takes a lot to learn, right?
So yeah. The reason for that is because of how quick you're expected to learn the language. You don't generally practice speaking it. It's pretty well only translation, and so you have to pretty well immediately get very, very, very acquainted with the grammar of the language. And so that's learning all the different tenses, learning all the different voices, active and passive, so on and so forth, vocabulary, how nouns function in a sentence. And that becomes difficult with Latin and Greek when you're a native English speaker, because it's a case language, meaning kind of like German, for example. Your nouns have gender, masculine, feminine, and neuter. And they also stick in a specific grammatical case, which informs what that word is doing in a sentence. So, for example, if it's in what's called the nominative case, that's going to be the subject of your sentence. So if the dog is walking, the dog would go into the nominative case. Beautiful. If you were walking the dog would then be the object of that sentence, so it goes into the accusative case. And that changes the ending of the noun. So it's a very complicated language when you go at it from an English perspective, because we're not familiar with those kinds of grammatic syntax. English does that through word order. Latin and Greek do not. Which is why you get the kind of famous meme of Cicero leaving the verb at the end of the paragraph, because that tends to be how Latin and Greek, quite frankly, structure their sentences, is you wait for the verb. You figure out what's going on once you get to the end of the sentence. You hope and you pray that it shows up and it's not implied.
Or in your case, it hasn't been chipped off of a tablet.
Exactly, yeah. So because Latin and Greek students are getting a little less education and a little less help through the university channels, we thought it would be a good idea to offer that support on our own for anyone who's struggling or just wanted the extra advice. And of course, the budget cuts have also impacted upper year courses, where as soon as you enter into second year Latin or Greek, you are immediately in a course with third years, fourth years, and graduate students.
Wow.
Which is a whole array of different levels of preparation and awareness of the language, which is quite frankly very difficult for the second years and a little too easy for the master's students. And of course, everyone has their own comfortability with the languages, but we want to make, despite these organizational changes, we want to make the language as accessible as possible to people who want to learn it. And as graduate students, the ones who are supposed to know the languages, which I learn every day, I don't know as well as I think I do, but that's the process of learning it. Mm-hmm. We wanted to try and be a part of that increased accessibility despite the structural changes.
No, I'm sure it is much appreciated by students who want to engage in these exciting ancient languages, but to get in, you need support to get your foot in the door to be able to learn all of these interesting things and to be able to do the incredible research like your project, right? You can't do this without without this language ability. So,
and you can't critique primary written sources easily without understanding them in their original language, because every translation will have its biases and have its different views. It's difficult to separate that from the text when you don't know the original language.
And of course, and like you mentioned earlier, like the colonial and imperialist history of the discipline, that has all of those things baked into it as well. So students have to learn these different layers of meaning and understanding, and the language allows you to kind of unpack some of those things on your own.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Anna, it has been so great chatting with you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, and the best of luck with the rest of your research.
Thanks so much for having me. I had a lot of fun.
So that is it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.